Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Good afternoon and welcome aboard to another exciting episode of Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie. And welcome aboard to my coolest of co-hosts, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Good afternoon, Annie, on this very last day of November 2012. 31 days left in the year, basically 31 and a half. Glad to be here. Seems like just yesterday we were saying Happy New Year.
It's right around the corner all over again. Oh, it's been a crazy year, hasn't it?
It certainly has. And remind everybody that you posted in the chat room, we will be posting our link to our website and a chance to win a very cool tote bag courtesy of Southern Sense, as well as our networking sites, Facebook, Twitter, you name it, we're there. I'm not going to say what I said last time because I don't want to get you upset. But anyway, we're everywhere.
We're up on Stitcher. You can download us from iTunes. And all the links are on our brand new website. It's a cool website. It's southernsense.webs.com. And if you become a member, we are going to randomly, after the beginning of the year, draw someone who's a member and give them this great tote bag. And Mike is going to include some of his Playboy energy drink, right?
That's right. Drive you to drink it, everybody.
That and little Jägermeister. Whoo, I can see you bouncing off the walls.
Well, that's been known to happen, at least not myself, but other people, that's for sure.
Yeah, also,
I actually collect my competitors because I like to read on what it's made of. So if somebody asks me a question, I'm kind of on top of things. But I actually, if you're in my room, I have shelves and a whole shelf that goes around my room of the competitors. So, anyway.
You never know what people collect. Hey, listen, also up on the website, we have a contact information up there, because what you're not seeing in the news is the devastation on Staten Island. They're talking about, you know, the North Shore of Long Island or the Jersey Shore, but no one is saying anything about what's going on in Staten Island. And there are whole neighborhoods just completely wiped out, completely decimated. The houses are gone. One guy said he found his house a mile away from where the foundation was. People have no homes. They've lost everything. So if you go onto our website, again, southernsense.webs.com, there is a contact where you can send a check, and it is tax deductible, to the Hurricane Relief Fund, care of the Knights of Columbus on Staten Island, Council 1662. Or there is a local restaurant owner. His name is Eddie Canlin, and he has reached deep into his own pockets and had his restaurant cook up food for everyone. He does this every single day. But as I said before, it's coming out of his own pockets, and he's running low on funds. So if you want to donate money so that the tray of food can be made in your name, you can buy one tray, 10 trays, 20 trays, as many as you feel. But if you do donate a tray of food, it goes directly to feed these people. So take a look at the website again, southernsense.webs.com, and see if you can reach deep into your pockets. And even if it's just $5, you know, it can go a long way. $5 can buy a case of water.
Is Staten Island your old turf?
No. I do have some friends, though, that do live up there. It is part of New York City, but unfortunately, it's the forgotten part of New York City. And at one point, I had an article I pulled up, and this drove me crazy. The city of New York sent their food cops into Staten Island, and because people were taking food from home, from churches or whatever, and, you know, volunteers, you know, you're not a health food professional, but because they weren't following the strictest letter of the regulations, they were telling them they could not serve the food. Is that crazy?
What the heck?
Is that crazy?
I'd have tossed them cops right out of there.
Oh, man, some crazy, crazy stuff going on. Absolutely. All right, we got a special guest that we hope she's going to be calling in just a little bit. Her name is Robin Olinsky. She's the new anchor at Glenn Beck TV. And Glenn Beck TV seems to be the hottest rage around, and it's really taken off like wildfire. So as soon as she calls in, we'll bring her on. But I want to remind everyone, we do start off each show with a dedication to a fallen hero. And if anyone wants to get really ticked off, I'm up on LinkedIn. It's under my own personal name. And I started a conversation. It was about Islamophobia. And some troll managed to try to get the best of me. And needless to say, it didn't work. He started to, I was certified by the VA for using fallen heroes in our dedications. And then he accused me of profiteering off of their loss. Well, number one, we do this to bring honor to these men and women who have sacrificed the ultimate sacrifice, their very life, for our freedoms and liberties. Number two, we do this so that we do not forget them. Every show, I want to remind you that we owe our freedoms and liberties to these men and women who, for over 200 years, stood up and defended our freedoms and liberties. And number three, I do not make a profit off this show. I wish I did, but for the 2.5 years I've been doing the show, not one single month have I ever earned a profit. It costs me money to go on the air. I lose money every month. So if that troll is listening, F you.
Oh, well, well, well.
Got me to curse on the air.
Little aggressive there, aren't we, Annie?
Oh, it pisses me off.
Considering that's the case, folks, we are everywhere, online, around the world. We are even in Margaret Thatcher's poontang. And with that said, we'll get back to the show.
Absolutely.
that's really it's another, I mean, it makes absolutely no sense.
I forgot to mention this. He threatened to sic the FBI on me. And I said, Bring it on, baby. Bring it on.
He obviously has you mixed up with me.
I said, I welcome them. I am not a phony. I am exactly who I say I am. And that can be proven 60 ways sideways.
Yeah, just go to your nearest town hall meeting in Buford. Look in the front row. And when they say any questions, the first person to stand up. Anyway, with that said, all righty, are we ready for our dedication?
Yes. This dedication is going out to Chief Warrant Officer 2, Timothy Wayne Moling. Let me just get myself a little organized here.
Hang
okay.
on. Take your time.
And here we go. Yeah, Chief Warrant Officer 2, number 2, Tim Moling. Chief Warrant Officer Moling should have been sitting in a camp chair puffing on his pipe. Specialist Rodrigo Gonzalez Garza should have been cracking people up with his jokes. Chief Warrant Officer 2, J.D. Smith, should have been telling rock climbing stories. And Specialist Will Tracy should have been celebrating his 28th birthday. Instead, the other soldiers of the 5th Battalion, 158th Aviation Regiment, stood stiffly at attention inside a hangar, blinking back tears as they remembered their fallen friends. The four men were all killed barely 36 hours earlier when a sandstorm engulfed their UH-60 Black Hawk about 12:30 a.m. February 25th, 2003, as they flew just above the desert floor. The helicopter slammed into the ground moments later. We don't know how or why this tragic thing happened, said Captain Martin Kendrick, the battalion's chaplain during the service. We can't bring these soldiers back, but we can remember the happy times with them. Friends say Moling and Gonzalez loved flying together. They were pilot and crew chief from the unit's Company A in Debelstad, Germany. Someone was going to switch Gonzalez to another flight Monday night, but he insisted on sticking with his pilot. But he's described Gonzalez, known to everyone in the unit as Gonzo, as a talkative joker who kept his pet mates laughing. A bundle of energy, he rarely sat still. Moling devoted every spare moment to his wife and three children. He took them in the family minivans on marathon vacations across Europe. In camp, he was perpetually laid back. He preferred sitting in a sauna to physical training. Since arriving in Kuwait in early February 2003, he had earned the nickname Puff Daddy and Mr. Howell because he would sit outside his tent in a camp chair, his feet up, wearing a hat and smoking his aromatic pipe. He was great to fly with, said Chief Warrant Officer 3, Paul Cahill, another Company A pilot. He was real relaxed all of the time. Smith and members of the 5-158 Aviation Company B based in Aviano Air Base in Italy. Both had volunteered for duty in Kuwait and both insisted on staying even after replacements had arrived for them from Germany. Just before his final flight, Smith and Gonzalez played spades with Chief Warrant Officer 2, Sean Davis, and another soldier. After the game, he had to go out and get his gear. He was flying, Davis said. Nothing at all seemed amiss. Then he and his crewmates were off in their fateful flight. Some 300 soldiers from their battalion turned out to hear the tributes. Lieutenant General William Wallace, the B-Corps commander, was among those paying respect. After hearing the tributes, First Sergeant Webb read the ceremonial roll call, including the absent soldiers. A rifle team fired three volleys in their honor. A bugler played taps. Senior officers and soldiers alike shared hugs of condolences and with the 5-158 Aviation Battalion and company commanders. We need to pack our shattered emotions, the chaplain said, and to get on to the task ahead. Chief Warrant Officer Molin left behind a wife, Lisa, children, Alex, Sarah, and Noah. To him and all of the other Black Hawk crew members who lost their lives on that fateful day, we dedicate this song, My Name is America, by Todd Allen Herndon, and we dedicate it to all the brave men and women who serve our country.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. But when I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger. And I'll rise up from the flames, and I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America, don't tread on me. America is my name. My strength was not taken from others, others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up.
That's Todd Allen Herndon. My name is America. And we want to welcome aboard our lovely guest today. She is an anchor at Glenn Beck TV. She had seat in row number one for the Casey Anthony trial. Let's welcome aboard Robin Walensky. Good afternoon, Robin.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me on the program.
Oh, it is our pleasure. Tell us a little bit about your background, because you've had an interesting career that you even wrote a book about the World Trade Center bombing of 93 and 9/11 attacks.
Yes, that's right. I've been covering crime and terrorism for more than 20 years, and I was in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. I was in 9/11. I covered the federal trial of Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman And my first book was a charity project called Covering Catastrophe, Broadcast Journalists Report 9/11. And it's basically 9/11 through the eyes of the TV and radio reporters. It really serves as a history document as viewed through the eyes of the people in New York, D.C., and Pennsylvania who actually, you know, saw the events, the unfortunate, terrible events on America's worst day unfold. Forward up the clock many, many years, and I've covered many cases, the O.J. Simpson trial in Las Vegas, the disappearance of Natalie Holloway in Aruba, the JonBenet Ramsey case, and then I was very fortunate to cover the Casey Anthony trial in Florida last year and had seat number one in the courtroom, and then did a book called Beautiful Life, the CSI behind the Casey Anthony trial. And basically that book, a portion of proceeds also goes to charity, but the book is really the case as told through the investigators from the Orange County Sheriff's Office that devoted 3 years of their lives, 365 days of the year times three, to dotting their I's and crossing their T's, hoping, you know, to have a conviction there, you know, to convict Casey Anthony, whom many in America believe is indeed the murderer of little Kaylee. And then when they got the not guilty verdict, they all had stories to tell, and so they tell their story to me.
Now, there's a recent controversy that came up saying that they really did not do a thorough forensics on the computers in the house. What are you hearing?
That responsibility was one person. There's a woman who's in charge forensically of the computers. I am really not sure what happened in that area, but it really, in my opinion, although a mistake and a huge error, I still do not believe it would have changed the outcome of the verdict of the trial. The jurors that were picked for this case, you know, one and one was not equaling two, and it was a case where you had to really apply logical thought, and they really wanted either a video of Casey doing it. They wanted to know what the witch's brew was, you know, how she made the chloroform. They were never told that at the trial by the prosecutor. And additionally, I think another mess up was that they never took the jurors to the first place I went when I moved to Orlando, and that was to the crime scene. And if they would have taken the jurors on a little bus, they had to go by that area every day from their hotel to the courthouse. I write in my book, Beautiful Life, one of my chapter's names is called The Scene Speaks. And it's very obvious to an individual that when you see where the Anthony home is and you see that you could walk to the area, this heavily wooded area that you would never even know exists unless you lived on that street, it is very clear who the killer is.
Now, that's interesting. So there were screw-ups in several different areas, not just one.
Correct.
Do you think they would have had a chance of having a guilty verdict?
You know, I think that there was a big strategy mistake, and that was that the defense team brilliantly portrayed Casey Anthony's father as a liar, and the prosecution really underestimated the power of one of the witnesses, and that was the lady that the father had had an affair with, who he denied it. She had two names. Her name was Crystal Holloway, and she also went by the name of River Cruz. And when she came into court that day, a lot of people thought that, you know, she wouldn't be a very reliable witness. But she turned out, in my opinion, and I've sat through many a court date over my 20-plus years in news reporting throughout this great country, and I will tell you that she was an incredibly powerful witness, and I believed every word she said. And so if the jurors like me believe that this woman was telling the truth about having an affair with George Anthony, and then George Anthony gets up there and says, you know, I did not have sex with that woman, a la, you know, Bill Clinton-esque style of denial, and you believe in your heart that George Anthony is lying about the affair, then you can also leap to, you know, what else is he lying about? But, you know, and I've said this on national TV. I did a lot of work for the Nancy Grace Show on HLN, and I've made the point on HLN that just because, you know, a man is lying about sex doesn't make him a baby killer. So while I do believe that George was lying about the affair, I do not believe that he had anything to do with the murder of his beautiful little granddaughter.
Okay.
Wow.
Mike, you have some questions, I know.
I do. First of all, Robin, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
I'm actually in a library, and they're going to order your book. So first, how can we get your book? Why don't you tell
them? Well, my book is available on Amazon.com, And a portion of the proceeds I am donating to the Children's Safety Village, which is a great organization in the Orange County, Florida area, where we fingerprint children and we teach them about stranger safety. So it's something that I'm very passionate about. Coming up in December, I'm going to be spending the day once again. It's my second charity event of the year, and we're going to be fingerprinting children. And it's something I'm very excited about doing, because the kids not only learn about the fingerprints and the importance of having them, but they also, really learn how to avoid the bad people, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's an absolutely wonderful charity.
Well, we're going to get your book. First question. This is just. We're going to need her for like 3 more hours, Andy. I'm not even started with the questions. This is going to take forever. I'm going to state an opinion, and help me factually. I basically think the police in Colorado totally tried to frame JonBenet's parents. They were smart and almost never cooperated for the simple fact they wanted to use the parents as national patsies. Go ahead.
Wow, I think the opposite. I think that the police, having covered that case extensively, I will tell you that I think it's the opposite. I think that the Boulder DA's office really never did a thorough job investigating the parents, as they should have. John Ramsey was the wealthiest person living in Boulder at that time. And I think that there are a lot of unanswered questions relating to the parents. Of course, Patsy has since passed away and died with her secrets. But I think that there was a lot of dysfunction in the family. I don't think the father was properly investigated, and I certainly don't think that the brother wasn't properly investigated.
What do you think of that melee afterwards with that dude from Asia or whatever?
His name is John Mark Carr, and at the time I was working for Fox News Radio, and I spent many a day out in Boulder waiting for him to get back. It's possible that he had something to do with it. The FBI has never been able to place him in Boulder at the time. The house that we have so infamously seen on TV now has, wrought iron 12-foot gate around it, and it's changed ownerships at least a dozen times since 1996. But I will tell you that at that time, when JonBenet was found in the basement, there was no wrought iron gate. It was just a wide open property where anyone could have come into the house, as you would on a street if your home is not secured. The only thing that really connects him to the case is that a Fox producer went back to his original town in Alabama where he went to school. And in his high school or junior high yearbook, it said SBTC. And that's SBTC was how the note on the steps of the Ramsey home, the ransom note, was signed, SBTC. And in his yearbook, it says, "Shall be the conqueror." So the only connection is that connection linking him to the crime.
Now, that is interesting.
Man.
That's something I didn't know about.
Yeah, that'll all be
all kinds of exciting stuff.
Yeah, that'll be in my next. That little nugget will be in my next book. I mean, I on these cases, I've spent many, I really research the players and get all the little fascinating nuggets, and it's kind of the small stuff that really interests me about the criminal cases I've covered, and of course the two terrorist acts on our country that I have personally been in.
You were inside the World Trade Center back in
February? I was standing outside the building working on the morning of 9/11. I was a New York correspondent for Associated Press, and unfortunately saw people go out the window, and their best option was to hold hands. Originally, when I looked up 1,000 feet in the air, I thought it was furniture going out the window, but then later, 3 days later when I was home and could actually see a television set, when I saw it was people, it was just absolutely horrendous.
You're talking about 9/11 or February 23rd?
I'm talking about the morning of 9/11 when people were forced to go out the window and jump. But in 1993, I was a reporter for 1010 Winds Radio, New York City, and I was, at the World Trade Center on that cold, snowy day, easily 12, 15 hours.
Yeah, I was on duty in the 9/0 precinct right across the Williamsburg Bridge.
Wow. So you know the horror of that day. I think the biggest problem, looking back on that, just reflecting on the case, is that had our government and Bill Clinton and Janet Reno treated the 93 World Trade Center bombing as a terrorist act and not classified it as a crime. I mean, keep in mind, Bill Clinton never came to New York, never said we're going to get these people who did this. Had they classified that incident as a terrorist act, I maintain there would be no 9/11.
I agree. And I remember the riots that broke out between the Hasidim and the Muslims that were up on Myrtle Avenue and Cypress Avenue. I used to drive past that mosque every day going back and forth to the precinct. I was really amazed that they did not treat it as a terrorist attack or an international incident, instead that they treated it as a domestic crime.
Correct. And, you know, I now live in Dallas, Texas, working for Glenn Beck, and it's interesting, you know, that people here, obviously the Fort Hood situation, terrorist act, is still very fresh in people's minds. And there are a lot of people here that have connections to Fort Hood and the base there. And, again, we run into the same problem with President Obama and Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Security Director, who, again, are classifying that as workplace violence when the shooter, the terrorist shooter, yelled Allah Akbar and shot our military straight in the head and had ties to Al-Qaeda and was inspired by bin Laden. And there are emails between him and al-Awlaki back and forth at the Virginia mosque. And it is very obvious to anyone who looks at that case that that is a terrorist act on our country. And yet our government, once again, just like in the 93 World Trade Center bombing, is classifying that as workplace violence, as a criminal matter.
Yeah,
workplace
and it does.
Violence?
Oh, yeah.
What the
Absolutely.
I got two questions, Robin. Number one is, looking at your picture, you're extremely pretty, to be being polite. You're, like, really beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about this blind sheikh. You know, we really never, other than he was on trial, he was blind, he was a sheikh, we never heard much about him. Like,
well, he's Muslim Brotherhood, and I would, you know, recommend for all of your listeners to research him. I mean, he was behind the assassination in 1981 of Anwar Sadat in Egypt after he shook hands with the Americans and the Israelis for a peace treaty. They assassinated Sadat. He was behind that. You know, he was behind the plotting of the 93 World Trade Center bombing, and I maintain that he's more dangerous than bin Laden. He's certainly a lot older than Osama bin Laden was, and he's inspired much more hate. And he is in Egypt considered, you know, one of the original Muslim Brotherhood figures. So I would encourage people that don't know who he is to look it up and really get educated on, you know, the Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, his co-conspirator Ramzi Youssef, who also plotted and was found guilty in the 93 matter, and really learn who these radical Islamists are.
Yeah, I agree. And what really burned me up is when I heard that they welcomed the Muslim Brotherhood to the White House. Our own Senator Lindsey Graham here from South Carolina sat down with them. And now, because of Morsi in Egypt, they have legitimacy as a political power, where originally, since 1920, they were outlawed. They're not doing it.
Yeah, it's very scary that the mainstream media, many of the reporters just refuse to open a history book, and they think that it's all about a democracy in Egypt, and they really have no clue as to the history. So, again, you know, this is something where, if you know, I'm the kind of person, guys, if I don't know something, I open up a book, or, you know, you can Google it clearly and find anything about anything online. And people really need to educate themselves because we are living in very dangerous times.
I agree. You know, we also had a guest on recently. He was talking about CARE and its ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, Dave Gobetz. And I had found out that Best Buy had sponsored a CARE convention over in Kansas City earlier this year. And I went and deliberately returned anything I bought at Best Buy to them and telling them that's why I'm returning it. You know, people don't realize that there are American companies and the media that are catering to CARE when actually CARE should be linked as a terrorist organization.
Oh, yeah, no question about it.
I have another question. Glenn strikes me as a person who has almost like a radar within himself. When he's talking to somebody, within like three words of somebody talking to him, he can sense if that person's a scammer or whatever. What's he like? He just, I'm almost obsessed with watching like him on YouTube and everything.
Well, he's now, we're running the Blaze TV, so we have Blaze Radio, which I work as his news anchor, and we have Blaze TV and a growing 24/7 cable network here in Dallas and New York and, you know, all around the globe. I will only say this, that the best boss I've ever had.
Do you ever end up going through one whole segment without getting him to crack you up?
Oh, you mean the interruptions of the newscast? No, you know what? He loves the news and he loves to comment. So I always have a couple of extra little news nuggets for him when I anchor my newscast. And again, you know, this is a person, Glenn Beck, who, you know, writes history books, who is a man of history, who studied the founding fathers. Again, and, you know, someone like myself who's, when you don't know something, not embarrassed to look it up and to educate himself on subjects that interest him. So I really find that refreshing, because I've worked in so many news organizations where the people just, you know, are spoon-fed a press release and then just regurgitate it, and that is not what we do here at The Blaze.
Okay. One other comment. If I were to ever be on trial, one person I would never want across from me, because she seems like an evil, evil person as far as a prosecuting attorney who would hang me, would be Nancy Grace. What's she like? She just seems so like as a prosecutor, just, she seemed like the type you never want to prosecute her like that.
Well, I've never sat. Yeah, I'm not from the Atlanta area, and I have never sat in a courtroom with her. I had the pleasure of meeting her once. I mean, I've been on the show many, many times over the last year and a half. But I had the pleasure of meeting her once during the trial, and she's a wonderful woman. And again, like, she's a patriot, just like Glenn Beck is. And I would say that she is a fan of reporters and guests who are prepared. Let me put it to you that way. If you are if you're a guest on her show and you are prepared, then she does not cut your mic. But she is not a fan of people who are not up on their subject matter. You know, and if I was sitting in her chair, I'd be the same way.
I can tell you, if there's anything I miss about the media, period, is I really, really miss Glenn's show on Fox when he would have Judge Napolitano as a guest.
Well, now you can watch him on www.theblaze.com. We're also on Dish Network, Channel 212, and possibly coming to other cable networks shortly. But we are on Dish on Channel 212 all across this great nation, and also on the Internet at theblaze.com.
Well, we have Glenn in the mornings on the radio here from 9 to, I think it's 9 to 12, just before Rush. I really loved those. I'll tell you, if I were ever running for office, to my left I would have Glenn, to my right I would have Judge Napolitano. Those guys are just, it's like having Babe Ruth and Joe Montana with you. I mean,
and wouldn't we have a different country?
We certainly would. I mean, I just think, in a lot of ways, I even think Fox was intimidated by intelligent men who could deliver the message so crystal clear. It didn't matter if you were in kindergarten or you were a scholar. Those two can deliver their message so crystal clear. I think it intimidates people in the media. I think they're like, oh, my God, any more of this, this person could become emperor.
We already have an emperor. His name is Obama. Hey, listen, Glenn started up a whole big to-do over his Obama and Pee-Pee artwork.
Right, yeah. You know, but you know what? The mainstream media, I'll just say this about that. I don't want to speak for him. I will just say that the mainstream media did not look at the entire clip in its entirety, and they missed the entire point of what he was trying to say. That, you know, speech is free, and he was commenting on other art, and that all of this art has the right to exist, even if you don't like it. So they really just zeroed in on one little itty bitty part of it and literally missed the entire message. I would encourage everyone to watch the entire segment, which is posted up on The Blaze.
Yeah, for those who aren't aware, he took a mason jar, and it wasn't urine in it. It was just colored water. And he took an Obama bobblehead, and Obama figure is dressed Christ-like, and dropped it into it. And if you also remember, several years ago in Brooklyn at the Museum of Art, they had a picture of Madonna with feces smeared all over it. If they are allowed to put up the Madonna and smear feces, then what is wrong with this mason jar with Obama dunked in it?
Exactly. And again, I would encourage everyone to watch the entire segment where he talks about all these different works of art and, you know, the right for it to exist in our country. But it's, you know, it's like the old soundbite, a politician or someone speaks for an hour on a subject and the media takes a 10 seconds out of an hour clip. So like with this, this is totally lifted out of context.
They like doing that with Glenn. I mean, of course, Glenn is a radical and he saw those other names that they label people like us who just basically see what's taking place. I mean, so he can say it's a beautiful day outside, and somehow they just love to misconstrue everything that guy says. You know, when realistically, at least I'm very critical of media people. Only thing I see of Glenn Beck is an intelligent person telling us exactly what is taking place in this world, or within our own country.
I will just say this, that I have never met anyone who is more well-researched than he is and our entire team here. And I would just leave it there. I would say that research and opening a history book is key, and I would encourage, you know, the rest of the mainstream media to get on board. I don't know if it'll ever happen. I've spent, you know, 20-plus years working in the mainstream media, and there's, you know, groupthink. My third book, which will be upcoming hopefully next year, is going to focus on that. I'm a huge fan of Bernard Goldberg and his books, Bias, Arrogance, and A Slobbering Love Affair, and he very much details in his walk and his career at CBS, you know, all of the mainstream media, left wing, how things are, you know, regurgitated, the bias that's involved. You know, obviously it was a New York Times bestseller, the book, how the media and why fell in love with Obama in the book A Slobbering Love Affair, and Arrogance is the book that was the second that came after Bias. And, you know, I remember years ago reading all three books and really relating to Bernie's experiences. And then, you know, I have my own walk, you know, working at the places that I've worked in my career, and I think it's time to put pen to paper for book number three and talk about it. I think that when I give speeches all over the country, people are most interested in those kind of stories.
Yeah,
wow.
When you go through the university system, it was very, very difficult to find anyone out there that wasn't left-leaning. And I remember my experiences back in the late 70s, and I had fun challenging them. But now if you challenge them, you're automatically fail.
Yeah, it's really a shame. It's really a shame. I have a, you know, an undergraduate degree. I have a master's degree. I teach at another university. And, you know, I don't want to say anything bad about anybody, but, you know, again, this is something that I'm going to hold off for the book and, you know, write very specific instances, because I think you can't just say things without backing it up with very specific examples. But luckily for me, I have many, many examples, probably enough to fill five books.
I'm gonna throw a question at you, and kind of almost just, I'll make a comment and follow up on it, kind of like you did the last time. It seems to me like the mainstream media, and this choreographs with a lot of your work history. If John Doe is found on the street with a knife in him, it's not a big deal. But if a co-ed, some beautiful co-ed girl, is carved up by, you know, whatever, next thing you know, you got breaking stories and you got interrupting this, and he or she has a nickname, you know, whatever the nickname may be, and they almost like feed off something like that.
But you know what, though? That's really the oldest story in the book. I mean, you think about it, the turn of the century with newspapers. I mean, even back in the day, before we had 24/7 cable and we only had, you know, Walter Cronkite News, and you know, newspapers were the thing. We didn't have internet. It was always sex stories always sell. The best story that you can have is the sexiest story. I mean, I'm very open about this in the Casey Anthony book that I wrote in Beautiful Life. I talk about this, and I'm very honest about it, that the very first time that I saw Casey and Kaylee on TV in Florida, I knew that that was going to be a national story and an international story based on the way both of them looked and how she acted. Little Kaylee was a beautiful, beautiful little girl, and we all know what Casey was about, and the public was fascinated. You can say from today till tomorrow that you didn't watch the trial, but the ratings showed a different picture. I mean, that was, you know, the O.J. Simpson trial of our time and, you know, of this decade. And I just think that, you know, sensational, sexy stories and the way people look, sell it.
Yeah.
Why was Scott Peterson so popular?
He was popular. I think it was a horrendous case that – I mean, I didn't cover that case. I mean, so I really don't want to comment on the nitty-gritty because I was not there at that trial. I do not cover the state of California. But I will just tell you that, I mean, look at Lacey. Here's this beautiful, young, attractive, 9-month pregnant woman carrying his son, and then she's murdered, and both people wash up separately. I mean, that's a horrendous, horrendous story. And then he's having an affair with another woman and lying to her. And then, I mean, there's a lot of sensational elements there, huh?
Yeah, sex sells. That's what it is.
Sex sells. It's so simple. And people don't want to hear it, but it is the truth.
Well, it is, obviously. That's why I threw the question out there. John Doe's found on the corner with a knife, and, you know, it's whatever. But here comes some beautiful, hot little blonde. Next thing you know, we interrupt the news to report. It's like, whoa. But you're right. I mean, that's very true. It's almost like it magnetizes people's attention.
Oh, no. I mean, look at Anna Nicole Smith. I remember being up on the roof of covering 9/11. I want to say it was like the fifth or the sixth year anniversary of 9/11. And a reporter from a Russian TV had come up to me and said, oh, I'm leaving. I have to go to the Nassau Bahamas for Anna Nicole's child is dead. And I said, Anna Nicole's child? I mean, I knew she had an older son, and she had just given birth to a baby. So I thought, oh, maybe, you know, something happened with the baby. And she said, no, it's her son. So anyway, I ended up going to Nassau Bahamas to cover the story. And, of course, we all know that her son, you know, died of a drug overdose, and who gave him the drugs? We all know that. And then the next thing you know, she's dead. And then the next thing you know, it's, you know, the who's your daddy, the baby daddy, who's the father of the child. And it went on and on. And then, you know, the story about her mother fighting to have her buried in Houston and her estate and, you know, her people wanting her, and she, in her own wishes, wanted to be buried in Nassau, Bahamas, and that whole legal fight. So I covered that case for almost a year and all the antics and the back and forth and, you know, burying two people and what she looked like. And why did you think that she was popular and in the news? Because she had an unbelievable story. Here was this young, beautiful woman who married this very old billionaire man. And still to this day, I don't think the money has settled. And anyone who tries to go after the money ends up dead. So it's a really crazy case and saga.
You said it the best. Anyone who tries to go after the money is found dead.
I mean, it's insane. It's insane. You know, the man, Mr. Marshall, he's dead. The brother is dead. She's dead. I mean, it's a long list.
It's like an Egyptian mummy curse.
I could talk to you for hours. All of this, how did you end up at Glenn Beck TV?
Wow. I think that, you know, Glenn was expanding and was looking for a news anchor who knew something about criminals and terrorists. That's the short version.
And the long?
No, that's about it. I mean, I've spent my whole career, really dedicating myself to educating people on 9/11. I mean, it's 11 years down in the history books. The 93 situation, we're coming up on 20 years. It's 19 and a half years. We have an entire generation of young people that know very little about 9/11 because it's not being taught in the history books, and they are clueless about the 93 bombing. A lot of times when I'm on airplanes or just, you know, when I see people like flight attendants that are young and, you know, they know nothing about it, they don't know the history. So it's a very dangerous situation that we have an entire country of people, young people, that know nothing about these two terrorist attacks. And, you know, they might know about 9/11, but they know nothing about 93. And I, you know, without the education of knowing how this took place and the backstory, that at the trial of the Sheikh and Ramzi Youssef, the prosecutor said, Your Honor, it was the goal of these two terrorists to topple the towers. So me, as just a regular General Simon Street reporter, I thought on my mind on the morning of 9/11, 8 years later, so when did it ever stop being the goal? That was always the goal, to topple the towers. That's why they put a bomb underneath it in February of 93. I mean, it's just so simple. And now my most recent article that I did for Glenn on The Blaze, and you can Google it if you go to theblaze.com and just put Walensky in the search engine, I write an article about how the 9/11 Museum was supposed to open this year, and it's now not opening for at least 2 years. And they claim that the reason is because they're arguing about money. So two blocks away, the Ground Zero Mosque is open, yet the 9/11 Memorial Museum is closed. I mean, what is wrong with this picture? And in my article for Glenn for The Blaze, I take people on a tour of the museum because I was down there a year ago. I had been invited on the 10-year anniversary to come and speak on a panel about my book, the first book, Covering Catastrophe. And as part of that day in New York, I was given a tour. So I'm one of the few people in the United States besides the construction workers that have actually been down there. And it's a shame because the Ground Zero, the cross is down there. And I kind of maintain that that cross should be, you know, the bars, the beams that formed in the shape of a cross that meant so much to people that were on the pile. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a huge fight over that.
Well, that piece, that cross, has been preserved, and it's 70 feet below ground in this museum that is locked. And I kind of made my feeling, and I make the case very clearly in my article on The Blaze, that this cross should be in Central Park to remind us of two things, that, you know, God is with us every day, but that also to remind us of the evil that exists in this world. And I think that you can't say one without the other when it comes to 9/11. And yet these treasures, this all part of American history, is on hold and locked, and it's very scary to me, very, very scary.
Yeah, for those who don't know what we're talking about, these two beams fell from the towers, and the way they fell and struck the ground, it was as if it was the crucifix, and it inspired a lot of people at the dig when they were doing the rescue work and reminding them that God does exist. And recently atheists have tried to sue, saying it should not be put on public display because it is in violation of separation of church and state. And that is the most outrageous thing I have ever heard, because they always fail to realize we have freedom of religion, not freedom from religion.
You know, and the other point I'd like to add to that is that not only is the cross 70 stories below ground in this locked-up museum, but, you know, the faces of 3,000 innocents who were murdered. The place is marked where they put the bomb, the terrorists put the bomb in 93. The fire truck that was, you know, crushed, is one fire truck was lowered through the ceiling last year. And then finally, one of the most riveting pieces for me was that somebody thought to preserve the last staircase, the last pulverized staircase is down there. And isn't it a shame that, you know, we can go to Washington, D.C. and see all of our monuments and learn about World War II and Vietnam and the Holocaust Museum and such, but yet in New York City, we don't have a 9/11 Memorial Museum that is open to the public 11 years later. I mean, it is an absolute outrage.
Sorry to interrupt, Danny. Any truth, I forgot who it was who said that several of the terrorists accused of the 9/11 attack are still alive. Is there any truth to that? I can't think of the guy who said it, but he's a conspiracy guy.
I've never heard that.
What's that guy's name? The conspiracy guy. Alex Jones. There you go. Okay.
No, I've never heard anything like that. No, so I just don't even want to comment because there's no truth to that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't believe it. That's why I'm asking someone like yourself. Annie, I have a question. If you don't.
No, go ahead.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Robin. When you have some time off, tell us a little bit about Robin. What do you like to do in your free time and, you know, family, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, you know, I will say this about that. You know, I lead a pretty private life, even though I have a very public job. But the greatest thing about my career is that it's never been a job. It's really never been work to me. And a lot of people look at me and say, wow, that's, you know, so crazy, and they really don't get it. And sometimes when I say that to people, they're actually offended. You know, I've had people over the years where I've said, you know, I don't feel like I go to work every day. I don't know if it's a jealousy thing that people just hate what they do. I'm not really sure. But I only know what it feels like to walk in my own shoes. And for me, every day has been a blessing because every day is different. Like no 2 days have been the same in 20 some odd years that I've been doing this. So I think, you know, now it's for me, working with Glenn, it's more about educating people and picking the stories and telling the stories on the blaze that the mainstream media is ignoring or not telling properly. So for me, it's kind of like a full circle, you know, moment where I can, you know, tell the truth and, you know, hear our phrase. I mean, the slogan of this company is "The truth lives here." So, you know, for me, that's so important.
It's a blessing when you end up having a career with something that you love doing, because if you love the job, it shows in the quality of your work. So I don't understand why anyone would be jealous of that unless, as you say, they're unhappy in their own position and don't have courage or the enthusiasm to correct that.
Oh, yeah. You were a little muffled on the line. I think I heard the question. But I think you have a better life if you enjoy what you do every day. You know, it doesn't matter what that is. You could be working on an assembly line and be feeling very productive. You can be a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home dad. You can be working as an airline pilot or in the military in a foreign country. But I think it really helps if you enjoy what you do, or at least some part of your day, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
I think your attitude and your altitude, your attitude depends or takes you to your altitude. One thing I got to say I really loved about Glenn Beck is I think at first I almost was challenging him when I was watching him, because he would take these icons that I was taught growing up that were just the greatest American leaders, that these people were the icons. And then he would break it down into whether they were presidents or the things that they did that I had no clue about because I was never taught it. And I also had boring teachers too, so I never researched a whole lot. But he just got me intrigued. So then you start looking up something he said about this president and be like, oh, my God, I never even knew this. And I think in a lot of ways he's a challenge to modern-day education, to where you're learning this, but it's really that's not realistic. He's telling you exactly not just the good things, but he's also showing you the negatives about leaders that we have been basically educated or hypnotized, indoctrinated into thinking that person was like an absolute great leader, when really they may have been a great leader, but they didn't follow the Constitution.
Well, you know what it is? It just kind of to sum up and agree with what you're saying, he really is the ultimate educator. And isn't it funny that he's known for using the blackboard? Because what do all teachers really use? You know, both my parents are teachers. They were always standing at it. You know, always my mom and dad are always at the blackboard with the chalk. So isn't it interesting that he really, at the end of the day, is the ultimate teacher of history? So I think that you know, more people need to tune in and give it a chance and open their ears and learn something. I think there's a lot of resistance for people. I have, you know, people in my own walk of life, friends, family members that just refuse to listen to the truth. I don't know if it's fear of getting to the truth, or they just love to be, you know, blissfully ignorant. I'm not really sure what it is, but my mind is not wired that way.
I think for me it was a little bit of both, but the ultimately, I really didn't want to look into the mirror and think, how could I have been so naive all these years? And,
yep.
You know, you can't change who you voted for. You can't change a person you campaigned for yesterday, but you can change that starting today. And I think a lot of it was me wanting that, oh, Glenn Beck's an idiot. Oh, why do I even need to listen to it? And then you sooner or later have to come to a conclusion that he knows what he's saying.
Well, listen, as we wrap up the hour here, because I'm going to have to go, I just encourage everyone to go to theblaze.com and really to read the articles that you will not get anywhere else.
And your book is Beautiful Life, the CSI, the K&E courtroom. You can find it up on Amazon. I also posted a link to the book in Amazon up in the chat room. So if anyone wants the book, just click on the link in the chat room. Or go to Amazon and type in Beautiful Life and Robin Walensky. You have been a fantastic and a wonderful guest. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. God bless you both.
Oh, thank you so much. If you or Glenn are ever in the Grand Rapids, Michigan area, you guys stop in. We're going to have gonna have to have lunch or something on me.
Wow. Sounds great.
I always love it when he says, let's go over to the blackboard. Thank you so much.
Have a great day, guys. Bye-bye.
Yep.
You too.
Thank you. Wow, Annie, where did you find that home run? She just was awesome.
Absolutely. She's a very lovely woman and very, very talented woman, too. So I encourage everyone to check out her books, Robin Walensky, and that is The Beautiful Life, Kathy Anthony Observations from the Courtroom.
Wow. Can you imagine all those court trials, the murder trials, and the she followed. My God, some of those trials were like, including the OJ, the world shut down when these people were on trial. It's like people were fascinated with them.
What people don't also realize is back in February of 93, when they tripped up on the World Trade Center, they bombed the World Trade Center in the first system. People died. Eight people lost their lives in that day, and this is from a bomb that was in the parking garage. My sister-in-law worked in the World Trade Center. On that day, she was at work. Her car was down in the garage. She did not get her car out for 5 years.
Wow.
You know, you have to remember, there was, I think it was something like that, 2,000 people were injured, but people were killed on that day, February 23rd, 1993. So people take a look for that on WikiLeaks, and they have all the information on there following the trial. But you also have to remember, they bombed Colby Towers that killed all those Marines. And again, that was a trial run to see how they can bring the towers down. You know, they succeeded in bringing down Colby Towers, but the construction wasn't the same. And then there was also the embassy in, was it Ethiopia? Oh, no, Kenya. Yeah, and it was another run on trying to see if they could bring down the towers. And some say that my sound is garbled. Is it coming through a little bit better?
Yeah, no, it's gargling pretty.
It's got to be the internet connection.
Normally is. I got a quick question for you before we if we're going to do a PSA. Someone wanted me to ask you, and that person is in the chat room. They wanted to know, while you were a New York police officer, did you ever see, what the heck is the guy's, John Gotti, or any mafia-type dealings?
I did not witness any mafia dealings. However, before I got to the precinct, in the area that was Sector John King, that was along the border of 9-4 and Queens, they unearthed, in the exact area, a little graveyard of the mob. About Donnie Brasco. And I got some beeping in my headphones. I don't know what, something's going on with the internet. But we also had an area up along Metropolitan Avenue, Leonard Avenue, that was an area of Italian America, and there was one restaurant that we banned going to because it was only be frequented by mob figures, and you don't see a limousine or something out front. They had a takeout window along the side, so we used to park the patrol car along the side to get our takeout, and the manager would come out and go, "Officer, you're chasing my business away," because we'd have the patrol car parked there.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And if anyone reads the book Donnie Brasco, that takes place between our priest, the 9-0, and the 9-4. So, yeah, there's a lot of activity up there.
So, like, would you take the police car home with you? Or?
No. This is New York City. This is not some little podunk department.
No, I don't know how they operate. So it just seems so cramped. The reason I ask that is it just seems like so cramped that, you know, there's no place to park. So, that would have been sweet to be in that, to live in that area during those times.
It's a challenge to park at times, depending on what neighborhood you're in. You've got to remember, NYPD has limited resources. It only assigns so many patrol cars per precinct. And those cars have to work all three tours. So, you know, you would
Yeah, never.
I mean,
never
it'd be
thought
a knife
turning
your keys, and they would go to the next team coming in behind you. So, you know, those cars were being used 24/7. Speaking about NYPD, there's a new little news item. It's a really a good news item that's been going viral. I want to play this clip and then get people to call in and make some comments on it, because I think with this Christmas season, this is a perfect, perfect thing. Let me play this clip.
Best story of the day for you now. He grabbed the headlines here in New York City. NYPD officer Larry DiPrimo saw a homeless man in Times Square. He had on no shoes. It was freezing cold outside. So what did he decide to do? He went inside a store. He bought the man a warm pair of boots and socks. And the random act of kindness was all caught on camera by a tourist who took this snapshot. Now NYPD officer Larry DiPrimo has become an internet angel, with the picture getting a lot of attention online. And Officer DiPrimo is with us now. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to meet you.
What made you do it?
It was extremely cold that night, and, you know, you see this gentleman, I tried to offer him to buy him a pair of socks, and he said, no, officer, but God bless you, thank you for asking. And when I seen something like that, you know, here it is, it's freezing cold out, and he has the heart to say, God bless me, and I just knew I had to help him.
It was the evening of November the 14th. It was bitterly cold in Times Square, and I understand, one of the things you noticed, aside from the fact that people were, was somebody snickering, hey, there's a guy on the coldest day of the year, he doesn't have any shoes on?
Yeah, that was what another thing that upset me at that time that not a lot of people know about. What brought my attention to it at first was that somebody was actually making fun of him. They said, oh, you know, you got no shoes, and they were laughing at him, and that's when I looked down at his feet, and he didn't even have a pair of socks on.
So you go into a shoe store, which is Skechers,
mm-hmm.
and you go in there, and the employee found out what you were doing, and he gave you the employee discount. You bought not just good boots, but you bought good boots that he could actually have for a while, right?
Well, what happened when I walked in there, I said, listen, I was like, I don't care about the price. I said, we need to get him a good pair of boots. I said, just give me whatever it is that you have the best of. And, you know, he came to me, he came back later, and they gave me a great pair of boots. They said, this is all weather. And I said, those will do. And
what did this gentleman say to you when you gave him the boots?
When I knelt down and, I surprised him. I said, listen, I have these pair of boots. They're in your size, because I had actually ran back to him to find out his size. I was like, I didn't find out his size there. But I ran back to him, and when I was sitting down helping him put on the boots, he just said, he's like, thank you, officer. He said, God bless you, and, you know, stay safe, and thank you for doing what you're doing. You've done enough already.
We wouldn't even know about this random act of kindness, officer, had it not been for Jennifer Foster of Arizona, who is visiting New York with her boyfriend. She mm-hmm. took that picture. She had this to say about what she saw.
I saw a New York police officer, uniformed officer, coming towards this gentleman. He did not see us. He did not see me. And he had boots in his hand. And I heard him quite clearly say, I have these size 12 all-weather boots for you. Let's take care of you. And the gentleman sat down against the wall. And I'm telling you, his face lit up.
You know what, officer? So many people would just walk by, but you didn't. Why?
I mean, as a police officer and just as another human being, you know, you want to help this gentleman, and I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize. You know, things like this happen every day.
You know what? There's a lot of people in this world that people look up to, and I hope that all the kids watching today and parents, that they will look to you as their hero and to emulate what you've
done. Thank
you. Great role model.
Kind of thing. Thank
you. And stick around, because I want you to talk about the reaction the world has had to that picture and what Ray Kelly gave to you.
Absolutely great. Thank you.
All right, officer, what...
I accidentally cut it off too early. But what happened was Ray Kelly gave him a pair of gold cufflinks that has NYPD police commissioner on it. And it was absolutely fantastic.
That's really a touching story. You picture NYPD's, and you obviously have been a New York police officer, but in the eyes of somebody who is not there or never been involved, you picture just all the bad things that have been out there. I mean, in this person, I mean, he did it without any cameras around. There's an old saying, a real test of one's conviction is when there's nobody around and you have to answer only to yourself. And clearly, this was just wonderful. I hope the employee who gave him the discount doesn't get fired, because as always, we know there's always some a company that pulls some sort of stunt like this. But I think that was also nice that the employee recognized it was basically out of his own pocket and gave him the employee discount. That's really that's just a great story.
Yeah, and they were $100 boots. No, they weren't.
Yeah,
cheap
boots. They're expensive. They're very good. I mean, I use them in the kitchen for working, but yeah, that's just a great story. Man, oh man, that dude's probably, if he ain't married, he's gonna have women hanging all over him.
Yeah, people don't realize all the little good things that cops do out there. I mean, I can't tell you how many nights, you know, you'd be riding around and you have your meal in the car and you see someone homeless sitting on a corner or something like that. And we would stop and say, hey, listen, you know, I can go pick myself up a burger somewhere else. Here, take this. And we would give them whatever we had. How many times we would walk in and buy them, you know, a juice or a sandwich and come back out and hand it to them. I had one foot post on Graham Avenue in the 90, and there was a children's clothing store out there. And in front of the little children's clothing store was this little mechanical horse. You know, the little kids love to ride on rocks back and forth. And you put a quarter in. You know, when I knew I was going to be working on Graham Avenue, I'd have my pocket full of quarters. Because these kids would go in with their parents. The parents were buying them school clothes or something to go to church in. And they didn't have a lot of money. And they would walk past the little horse, and you'd see the kid's face just fall. I just, you know, go, come here, put the quarter in, put the kid up there, and their face would just light up,
They caught the penny at our store. A quarter? Wow.
Yeah, it was quarter.
Expensive in New York. That's really, really awesome. I was going to also comment. What's it like preparing for, like, a New Year's Eve? And you're a New York cop on Times Square. As an outsider, it was the big thing, obviously, with Dick Clark and Times Square. And gosh, you just imagine what was preparation like? What was all that like? Because from an outside standpoint, when you're watching this on TV, I mean, you don't know everything that goes involved. You just see the whole world is congregating to New York City. And it's obviously the big, the big New Year's Eve draw, which will be taking place in 30 days.
Well, I never did any duty in Times Square on New Year's. I can't answer that. I have done it inside our precinct. But when you handle something like Times Square, there's a unit inside 1PP that does all of that planning. And that would be from placing people to direct traffic, to the day before, making sure the barriers are dropped in the specific location so you can reroute traffic, whether it be automotive or pedestrian, sending notification out to different precincts and commands, telling the roll call you need these people. Somebody will be allocated, allowed to be coming in on overtime. Others will be on their regular duty. And it's a huge, huge plan. And they do this every year, so, you know, these guys have set plans in place. The only thing that would be changed is if the people that are doing the performances or whatever, if something there changes and they need now to reroute manpower to another place. It's a months-long preparation. It's not something that happens just overnight.
I'm fascinated with New York, especially being a police officer. I love it when you come upon a situation where, what happened? I didn't do anything. Or, he did it. No, she did it. I didn't see anything. You went just as a cop, you know, you're thinking, oh, my God. Nobody saw anything.
Oh, it can be very interesting, to put it politely.
How long does it take you usually to figure out who the liar among the group is, or the guilty party?
You just assume everyone's lying.
That's a little fun.
Yeah, but I got to hand it to this officer, DePrimo. He did a fantastic, wonderful thing. And the fact was, he actually knelt down with the homeless guy and was helping him put the socks and boots on. Yeah, and when I thought of that, I thought of, you know, our Lord Christ washing the feet of his disciples the day before he was arrested.
Yes, that's really, I mean, that's really, really touching. Incidentally, is anyone aware of, if you can Google this, who Officer DePrimo's favorite college football team is?
I would say Notre Dame, because he's Italian American.
Yes, it is. He, in one of the interviews, he does talk about what a good year it has been and a positive outlook, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, he said he did this without, obviously, as he's putting socks on someone, there are many other police officers probably doing similar acts of duties, not getting the credit, et cetera, et cetera. But he culminated his interview with, I'm not sure if it was a Connecticut station, it was a station out east, where he said, you know, it just culminates a great year for, he says, everything, including Notre Dame football. Thinking to myself, Regis is about to call that guy and say, hey, how would you like to go to the national championship game with me? But, I mean, it is. It's just, you know what? I mean, as he's putting socks on, there's these assholes laughing. I mean, I don't know, you never imagine yourself in those situations. But in today's world, it could easily be any of us, especially with the way things are going. And, I mean, to would laugh at somebody like that, I think your analogy was so perfect, Annie, is that just hours before his death, it was Jesus who was washing the feet of the disciples, because everyone was looking around for who's going to wash our feet.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, one little side note, that the woman who took the photo and posted it, she herself is in law enforcement out in Arizona, too.
She's what?
She herself is in law enforcement out in Arizona.
Oh, okay. All right. That's the I forgot what her name was, but that is really cool. Now, what's it like when you're walking the beat? I mean, it's just like on Seinfeld and on NYPD Blues. Just like all these shops are just so, or these old businesses are so close to each other, and I mean, like everybody still knows everybody, et cetera. Is it really like that, or is it more of a corporate, you know, you
no.
just don't know.
So you have tons of little mom and pop shops, and you know, you got to imagine one city building right directly next to another. You may have a small alley separating some of them, but you know, literally side by side, like one whole big long strip mall with apartments all above it. Think of it like that, apartments and offices. And honestly, most New Yorkers will walk down the street and they will not look you in the face, you know. You don't know your neighbors. You can live in
really?
The same building your entire life and not know any of your neighbors. So,
wow.
You need something like the Seinfeld. It's you would find people who have a small little clique, but not something where you know every single person in the building and things like that. You know, that you find very rare, unless you have a building where it encourages that, and you'll find that in a more upscale neighborhood rather than in the type of neighborhoods that I walked in. You know, a lot of them just don't want to know their neighbors, so they don't get themselves involved in something that they may have problems with. And that's the way they live their lives. You know, it's a sad truth. But
what,
then again,
what's
we.
Weird, I was going to ask you, is this true? You had mentioned we did a show dedicated to your buddy Eddie Byrne, whose whole family was in law enforcement. How did you even get in there, considering you need to know somebody? It seems like you have to have a connection to get in anything in New York.
No, not true at all. All they have to do is just apply for the test, take the test. You have to be within a certain age, and then you have to pass a certain type of a score, and then you go through an interview, which sometimes take more than a year, where they go through your entire background, everything from the very first traffic ticket to what cars you drove. You go through extremely in-depth background. Then you go to a psychological exam and then the physical exams. And after that, you're put into the police academy. Now, for me at the time, the police academy, I believe, was 6 months. Yeah, 6 months. I don't know what it is now. I know they extended it, and they also extended the time people on probation. Because when you're at the academy, at the time I got out, you were on a two-year probation. So if you really screwed up, you know, they don't need an excuse. You're gone. So it is very rigorous in trying to get in. And, you know, people slip under the radar. I'll admit that. And in any organization, they can. But I got to say, less than 0.1%, 0.1%, not 1%, 0.1% of New York City Police Department, you'll find someone crooked. And that is a damn good number.
Yeah, it sure is. So while you're in your training, your basic training, so to speak, are you compensated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because you're there full day, a full entire day. You know, you go home at night, yes, but still, you do a complete 8 hours and 35 minute tour. And, yeah, you are working.
So does the NYPD pay weekly or biweekly?
Biweekly. Biweekly.
No. I'm gonna have to talk to that union over there about changing that. I'm fascinated with that. You know, I was sitting down just with some friends. Someone said, "Is it your friend Annie? Is she really a New York cop?" And I said, "Yeah." And we just talked about how many TV shows have made it big, as far as they were basically law enforcement or hospital types that took place in New York, and we actually looked it up, and this started back in the 50s. I mean, it's just like all these shows that took place, most of them took place in New York City. Some took place elsewhere.
Carp D4, where are you?
What's that?
I said, Carp D4, where are you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as we obviously know, NYPD's, well, as of recent, in Law and Order, etc. Long before any of us were even born, they had these shows where they're always running around New York, and if you even think about it, where's Superman from? Metropolis. I mean, it's just whatever. New York is just like it happened first in New York, and as we all know, in sports, the whole world sadly revolves around New York.
Yeah. Well, I gotta let everyone know, you know, I did not come out of, you know, high school and go straight in to become a police officer. When I got out of high school, I actually contemplated going into the Navy, and I decided I'm going to be a bit of a discipline problem, probably deck my CO, so it was not a smart idea. I ended up putting myself through college. I worked two at one point, three jobs just to pay for my tuition. I did not take out a loan. And then when I got out, I bought into a travel agency, took out a loan, business loan, and took out a partnership and owned a travel agency for about 4 years. And then I left. I sold that and ended up becoming an office manager, or actually the administrative assistant to the senior partner of a law firm, a mid-sized law firm. And from there, I went to work for American Express, where I worked myself up to an assistant manager. And in American Express, I just said, that's it. I had it with the corporate world. I threw my hands up. I said, I'm tired of the BS in the corporate world. You know, you're getting nitpicked for the silliest and stupidest of things, and you put up with people that don't know how good they have it. I wanted to do something. I wanted to do something with my life that made sense, that was worth something. I wanted to be able to go home at the end of the day and be glad I did my job. And that's when I decided I was going to become a New York City cop. Actually, I had applied for Nassau County in Suffolk, and it was New York City that took me first, and that's where I ended up.
Wow. Did you ever get in a shootout?
I came very close on a couple of occasions, and I do remember this one story. Now, we carry these radios, not like the type of radios I had. They were big, bulky radios back then, and it was a midnight tour, and I hear shots being fired. And look down the street, there's a crowd of people running towards us. And there was a club at the other end of the block. It was a one-way street, and now we're going the wrong way down the one-way street, driving through this crowd. And there's a guy, and I didn't physically see the gun, but I could see the muzzle flashes coming off his hand, which meant he's firing open. And my partner goes, "Shots fired. Effing shots fired." He actually said the word, "Fucking shots fired," screaming this into the radio. And the dispatcher hears me laughing because I'm listening to him cursing, because you're not supposed to curse on the air. And we go driving, and we get the shooter and everything else. And all I can think of is that, you know, here you're driving into someone firing. You're heading straight into these shots being fired between a car driving down the street and this guy standing on the street. And what do? I laugh. Yeah, it's amazing the reaction you have. You don't think, you just react, you do your job. I mean, I had someone coming at me with the knife one time, and it was just half an inch from my stomach. I came close to shooting him. And thankfully I didn't, because last second he saw me pulling my weapon and he dropped the knife. Now, that could have been someone who would have been dead. I would have been completely justified. but it's your reaction and what you see and how well you do your job.
I love on TV shows when the cop arrives and then all of a sudden someone runs. Sometimes in the shows, the police officer is a little older, seasoned veteran, where he looks and is like, oh, no, because they don't want to go running after him. I always love that. It's just, wow. Man, yeah. Oh, man, not to mention the good restaurants that are around there, those mom-and-pop restaurants. God, some of that food's just got to be out of this world.
Oh, absolutely. And to this day, I still cannot find any place down here in South Carolina that can make mozzarella like they made it on Metropolitan Avenue. There was a little Italian man that had a little hole in the wall, Metropolitan, and like, she made the world's best mozzarella cheese, and nowhere can I ever find anything like hers. Oh, God, some of the food was fantastic. I'm lucky I didn't end up weighing 300 pounds.
Yeah, you know, I worked for a guy on an internship where he's at Caesar's Palace, but he said his mom and dad have been running their business somewhere in New York, he said, for 50 years. He says, and they don't even like to visit. He says, I said, why don't they ever come visit? And he's like, they don't like to. He says, everything around the, he says, within a three-block radius, he says, they have their whole world. He says, church, schools, everything, right there. And I'm like, they don't even visit? Nope. He said, they love where they are. He says, just,
yeah, well, everyone has to remember, New York City is not all these big skyscraping apartment buildings. You've got other areas that, you know, you have people with a little tiny lot. You know, the city is not everything. It's not Manhattan. And where I worked in Idaho, you had one area where, yeah, you had the projects, you had all the apartments. Another area, especially around Christmas time, each house, it was almost as if it was a competition on the lights. And we used to love to go driving down that around Christmas time and just looking at all the decorations. And, oh, it was so beautiful. And they are. They're little houses, you know, individual plots, you know, not a big yard. You know, you can't put an in-ground swimming pool in there. But, you know, there are neighborhoods like that. And then you have areas like Brooklyn and outsiding areas of Brooklyn and Queens where you have people with larger lots, I mean, more expensive houses and stuff. And people do have maybe quarter acre or so. You know, there's a lot of nice areas. It was moving to our last few minutes here. My show went so fast.
Yeah, it did. When you have a guest like we had, man, she could have been in for 5 hours. I could have, oh, my God. Why couldn't I do something like that?
Yeah, and let everyone know that next week we have coming back on board Dan Bongino, our new senator-elect from Maryland. He was also another fantastic guest, so I'm going to enjoy talking to him and looking forward to his new term in the Senate.
Amen to that. I'm looking forward to talking to him, too. What a great, great guy he was, and what a great guy he is, and one of the very – we didn't have a lot of shiny moments on election night, but he definitely is one of them.
So I hope everyone joins us again on Tuesday when we have Dan Bongino. So until then, I want you to have a healthy, happy, and safe weekend. And good night, and God bless you all.
Happy December, everyone.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American. Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up? Don't sit down. Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud, Americans.